Welcome to Lung Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. David Spiegel from the Sarah Cannon Research Institute in Nashville, Tennessee. And to begin, he presented a patient from his practice.
This is a gentleman who's 73 who presented with limited stage small cells. So he received carboplatin, etoposide, and radiation in a very standard way and actually did well for a long time, several months, not quite a year, and then had a documented recurrence in his liver. We biopsied and confirmed recurrence. And so we actually had a study at that time with nivolumab and ipilimumab, and this gentleman went on that. And I think you're aware, off study, we'd offer a gentleman like that either a retry at platinum etoposide or topotecan, drugs that have some activity, but you know, limited kind of efficacy overall. So he agreed to participate in this study and received nivolumab, ipilimumab, and did well for a long time, actually had a response pretty early. And then about 6 or 8 months into his nivo-ipi, he began developing a rash, and it was a pretty big rash. I initially managed it with steroids and holding therapy as the study mandated, but it got to a point where steroids weren't working, and I referred him to a colleague of mine, a dermatologist, who she was stumped, and we tried a number of different topical things, and the rash was bothersome to him. It wasn't just, you know, an appearance thing. It actually troubled him with pruritus. And he's an outdoor guy and just didn't like that, where he couldn't show his extremities.
Could you talk about the distribution of the rash and sort of what did it look like?
This was actually over his entire body, actually spared his face for the most part,
wow.
But it was clearly over his torso and his extremities. And so what we're talking about is an erythematous maculopapular rash. So with raised areas and places he was scratching and kind of cutting open and leaving scabs. So pretty serious rash, a little bit more severe than we would see with something like osimertinib or erlotinib, probably on the order of something we saw back in the day with panitumumab, cetuximab, when we were using those in lung cancer. So what was really fascinating, Neil, is my colleague, the dermatologist, sent him to a tanning bed. And so he shows up with his great tan and his skin lesions are all gone.
Wow.
And I wasn't aware that tanning beds are used, the ultraviolet rays are used to actually treat inflammation of the skin for various disorders, psoriasis. I don't really understand why it works, but it seems to work. And my dermatologist, she wasn't exactly sure how it works, but she says it does work. Anyway, this went on for a little while. Good control, went back on therapy, and then it came on again. And by the way, his time in the tanning bed was about 5 minutes twice a week. So it wasn't the typical, I guess people spend a lot more time in tanning beds. So this is one of those rare situations where we don't endorse people going to tanning beds, but this seemed to help him for a little while. So he got on the kind of a payment plan, showed up at the tanning bed a couple days a week, and it was working, and then it stopped. And what happened was we had to stop therapy. I had to say to him, you know, we can't safely put you back on this study. Although I can get access to nivolumab, ipilimumab off study, you know, I'd recommend we stop.
And how long had he been on treatment at that point?
So about 8 months. And he had a period of on and off where we got his rash better and then he went back on, but ultimately came off.
And where was the distribution of the tumor before therapy and then how did it change with therapy?
So he had disease in his chest originally and then recurred in his liver. And then with treatment, those areas didn't disappear, but they responded, they shrunk. So here's what's fascinating. We stopped therapy last summer, about this time last summer. And I made a deal with him, like all patients who have toxicity, that we would just watch him closely. And so initially I had him come in every month to assess his rash and see how he's doing. And we'd image him every other month. He just came in 2 weeks ago for his imaging. First of all, his rash is gone. That's improved. But he's decided to stick with the tanning bed. He likes the look of it, and he thinks it helps keep things at bay. He's off steroids. And then here's the deal. On imaging, he's almost in a complete response. I can still see lesions in the liver and the lungs, but almost not. I think if you didn't know he had cancer, you would say that was almost perhaps scar tissue or benign nodules. I've never seen anything like this in small cell, where you can be on therapy for recurrent disease and then be off therapy for a year with no progression. I mean, it can happen, but this is not an experience we see with cytotoxic drugs. So It's a fantastic story, and he's pushing me now to say, David, do we need to even do imaging anymore? Can I just come in, you know, twice a year? So we have stretched it out a bit. We do imaging every 3 months now, and then I'm gonna back off if we go another year. But 1 year off therapy, 2 years basically since he recurred in his liver, and basically almost 3 years since he was diagnosed. So I don't think he's cured. I think he's in a near CR and probably will stay that way for a while.
Any other autoimmune complications at all?
No, nothing. You know, there's been some publications on this, but that's been generally my experience. If you look at the kind of different toxicities you can see in organ systems, I don't usually encounter patients who have more than one. So you might have a thyroid issue, you might have a skin issue, I have a patient who has diabetes, but it's not like they get a constellation of every organ gets inflamed. And I'm not sure why that would be, but it seems to be that when you get that acute toxicity, you don't get it in other organs. Maybe that's because you just stop what you're doing and institute anti-inflammatory approaches. And perhaps if you just kept going, every organ would get inflamed. But I can't think of a situation where I've had multiple toxicities in different organ systems. Maybe a thyroid plus something else would be the most common.
That's really a fascinating observation. And I guess the other thing, you know, sort of related to this is there any correlation between toxicity and treatment benefit? As you discussed that case, I was flashing on a case that an oncologist presented. I think it was renal cell of this patient who had this terrible Sicca syndrome and had this wild, you know, CR to, you know, a checkpoint inhibitor. What do we know about, you know, correlations of toxicities or even specific toxicities with treatment benefit?
So there have been some data on this, but I would limit it. You know, these are kind of large case series. A lot of anecdotal experience, not just myself, but colleagues in Nashville around the country who describe this. And you know, when you listen to what's going on in the CAR T world, on the heme side, patients who are getting these high fevers, these cytokine release syndrome, almost near-death experiences, and then they come out of it, it kind of fits with what you see with the checkpoint inhibitors, where those patients who seem to go through this gauntlet of toxicity often come out the other end doing well. I have had people who've had toxicity and no benefit, you know, and that's a nightmare. But I would say, and it's anecdotal in my experience, most of the people that have had severe toxicity have had fantastic benefits from checkpoint inhibitors. Maybe not a surprise, you're trying to activate your immune system at some level that's going to get to a point where maybe it goes overboard and harms an organ, you know, and that balance, I think, is probably not very wide, where, you know, you get benefit and then you don't create some type of side effect. So I always encourage patients that you could do well without toxicity, but if you have toxicity, it may also mean you're benefiting from therapy.
Again, really fascinating observation. Can you talk a little bit about the spectrum of what you see in terms of dermatologic problems with checkpoint inhibitors? I've heard that minor problems are extremely common. What do you typically see? I assume some of these people have gotten biopsied. I don't know if your patient had got biopsied. Do you see any kind of autoimmune things or inflammatory things or just a bunch of, you know, mess?
Yeah, well, I think our dermatologist did biopsy him. I don't think anything came back on that. In the early checkpoint studies, biopsies were pretty routine, particularly in the combination studies with things like CTLA-4 antibodies. I think the distribution with single agent checkpoint inhibitors, drugs like PD-1, PD-L1 inhibitors, in general, it's been a mild skin toxicity that's a macular rash that is diffuse, not necessarily limited to a certain part of the body. Kind of reminds us of things we've dealt with before with the EGFR antibodies or the EGFR tyrosine kinase inhibitors in terms of relatively easy to manage with topical steroids, occasionally, you know, steroid shampoos and steroids by mouth as well. The big change for me has been when we have done the combinations, and it's not just CTLA-4 antibodies, but the other combinations seem to have enhanced the severity of these reactions, where now you're getting not like shingles in terms of limited severity, but shingles in terms of this evolution of inflammation leading to scabbing over and being irritating to patients and often scratching and leading to bleeding.
You say shingles as in zoster?
Yet, you know, the thing about shingles is it tends to be limited to, you know, a dermatome. But what's unique about shingles, I think, is that those lesions tend to, you know, be painful. They erupt and they then eventually crust over. And so I've seen patients with shingles-like toxicities where you get this kind of intense, painful, itchy distribution of lesions that then eventually kind of crust over. It's not shingles, but it looks like that at times. And that's different than what I have ever seen with just the TKIs or the other monoclonal antibody rashes we've seen. I think it's all about catching it early, holding therapy, sometimes stopping altogether. Rash has rarely been a reason I've had to stop immunotherapy for patients with lung cancer, but it happens. In the case we described in small cell, that's a rare case where I've actually had to hold therapy because the skin issues got too bad. I have another gentleman right now, I'm treating a young man, I was 48 with advanced lung cancer when we met, who's doing quite well, but he's on a checkpoint inhibitor now, actually pembrolizumab. But he has baseline psoriasis that was managed with steroids, Enbrel, and he's actually become kind of a close friend. And so we talk a lot about his skin. And I just saw him last Friday, and he says, David, it's like my skin is on fire. I have this electrical sensation throughout my body. And last Friday, he asked me if he could hold his pembrolizumab because he knows when it gets to a point where it's getting too severe. When you look at his skin, actually you don't see much. You know, on his ankles and on his elbows, you can see some excoriations that are typical of psoriasis. It's just what he feels.
Well, that's really fascinating, disturbing. A couple more words about small cell, and then we can move on. So I don't know if this patient might have possibly had a PD-1 level or tumor mutation burden analysis.
Yeah, we did. So the mutation burden was something minor. It was 12, as I recall. You know, you could argue, well, that's what showed benefit in the 227 non-small cell trial. The more interesting cases I've seen with TMB in response have been quite high TMBs of 115, of 498.
What about the PD-1 level on this patient?
Yeah, I didn't do PD-L1 testing on him. Actually, for the study, it was done centrally, but I don't know the results.
I've heard it said, I don't know how strong the data is, that small cell is often TMB high and PD-1 low. Is that your take?
Well, it's often PD-L1 low, that's correct. I'm not convinced on the TMB story. I mean, we certainly have a number of people who've had high TMBs, but I have not seen enough data to be convinced that this is something you expect for patients. And then what's the cutoff? Is it 10? Is it higher?
Right.
But it may be a more deranged tumor. You know, we were just looking over a number of cases last week of patients who've got great responses, and there are high TMBs, but we're seeing, now you see other things too, right? And so you don't know if there's a pattern there or not. Obviously, your RB loss is huge, but not something we expect to correlate with immunotherapy.
And in terms of where we are today with small cell, you know, when we ask investigators, what's your typical second-line therapy, systemic therapy, a lot of them say ipi/nivo outside a trial setting. This man got it as part of a trial, but is that your second-line therapy?
It has been. We were part of the original study that actually demonstrated benefit of Nivo initially and then Nivo Ipi. And then once it became NCCN compendia listed, it became kind of a standard. It's hard to go back to topotecan. What I've noticed, though, is a lot more enthusiasm recently for pembrolizumab. That's been a bit surprising to me. I know this ASCO, you know, we're a little bit more encouraged about pembro, but I've not yet been convinced from the data. We initially had some high responses approaching 30, maybe 40% with pembrolizumab in that setting.
You're talking about small cell, second line small cell.
Yeah, that's correct. Then with follow-up, that number dropped well below half that. And then now we're seeing that maybe the benefits are a little bit better than the interim analysis. I think pembro is probably a reasonable drug. But for me, if I'm going to do immunotherapy, I think Nivo-Ipi right now seems to confer the most benefit among the checkpoint inhibitor studies I've seen. But, you know, let me just quickly mention, just a few weeks ago, we got word that a pivotal randomized phase 3 study with atezolizumab, platinum etoposide in the first line setting was positive for PFS and OS. We were part of that study. I think that's a new standard of care, and I think it's just a matter of time before the FDA approves that. So we were going to have atezo, in my opinion, available first line, hopefully soon. And then the question will be, is there a role for Nivo-Ipi anymore? And, you know, those would be things we'll need to study.
So, yeah, that's really exciting. You know, you would kind of see the way things are going in non-small cell, so certainly not a gigantic surprise to see that.
And then we just, I mean, this stuff isn't rocket science. I mean, we've been eager to get into limited stage small cell with immunotherapy. And this past week, we heard they're launching a global phase 3 study in limited stage small cell. Neil, it's basically Pacific all over again with Durva, but Durva Tremi following platinum, etoposide, and RT for limited stage small cell, but a registration study.
Durva Tremi is what, a consolidation for a year or something?
Yeah, just think of Pacific for stage 3 non-small cell.
I was going to ask you also about Durva and mesothelioma. I saw there was a paper at ASCO on that. Not to get too far off that, but any comments about that?
Well, certainly the CTLA-4s by themselves have looked pretty dismal in mesothelioma. You know, I think the checkpoint inhibitors, a PD-L1 inhibitor like durvalumab, you know, basically could be a way forward in the refractory setting since we don't really have anything except things like gemcitabine or vinorelbine. But again, I'd go back to Nivo-Ipi. I think some of the data there, I was the biggest skeptic of Nivo-Ipi in the beginning because of toxicity issues and not convinced it's better than single agent checkpoint. But the data with Nivo-Ipi in various malignancies has been compelling. And as we get a little bit more accustomed to dealing with side effects, I think that doublet is here to stay in probably a number of different malignancies besides melanoma and renal cell.
Well, also, I get the feeling that as people play around with the dosing of the Ipi, this maybe is not as terrible as it was in the beginning.
Yeah, you know, Matt Hellman's pivotal trial, I always talk about this because it's right there in the publication. They did study an every 12-week dose of 1 mg per kg Ipi. And if you look at the data from a phase 1 study, it looks as good as the every 6-week dose of Ipi. To me, reinforcing the idea, maybe you just need a little bit, you know, sprinkled here and there. In that example, you know, 4 times a year. This idea of giving Ipi every 3 weeks, you know, to me seems unreasonable. It may be a tumor-specific issue. I think you probably need little Ipi. You need some, but not as much as, you know, some of the studies have suggested we need to do.
One other thing about small cell, and I actually asked if you had any cases, and you have this 70-year-old woman with extensive stage small cell. But I was curious about this Rova-T. We saw some more data at ASCO. Could you kind of talk about what that is, where we are with it, and just what happened with this lady?
The punchline, I think, is that Rova-T eventually will make it on the market. But the story of Rova-T has been a bit of a roller coaster and a roller coaster ride that kind of started before immunotherapy came out, and now it's caught up in the middle of immunotherapy. And that's good news for patients with small cell. Rova-T is what's called an antibody-drug conjugate. So linking, very much like T-DM1 in breast cancer, linking a toxin to a target, in this case, DLL3, pretty widely expressed in small cell lung cancer. Maybe 2/3 of our patients have some form of expression. The early experience, the phase 1 study, and we were a part of this, and Charlie Rudin led the publication in Lancet Oncology a couple of years ago, showed benefit in both sensitive and refractory relapse settings and responses that maybe approach 40% in some settings and appeared to be safe at that time. And what's happened over time is there's been this kind of launching of studies to get Rova-T on the market, and several are in progress right now. Right before ASCO, though, a key study, what's called the Trinity study, which was Trinity as in three, third line, this was just a simple single cohort study that said basically if you had relapsed small cell lung cancer and you've been through platinum etoposide and you've been through topo, you can get Rova-T. Interesting trial in that you just get 2 doses of it. You get 1 dose, and then 6 weeks later, get another dose, and you can get redosed after that if there's progression. In that trial, which was designed to be for accelerated approval, the company announced that they did not achieve the kind of results they were hoping for, responses north of 30%. Actually, we're seeing responses around 15%. And so they've decided to not go for accelerated approval and wait for the pivotal studies. Here's what I think about Rova-T. I think it's active. I think it has some toxicity. I think the toxicity is directly related to the toxin. And the toxicity that physicians are experiencing, and patients, I should say, are experiencing, is the accumulation of fluid. And so you're developing edema, sometimes anasarca, sometimes critical effusions in places like the pericardium and pleura that make patients and doctors want to stop the therapy. That's the reason for dosing twice. This may not be just a Rova-T problem. This could be just an antibody drug conjugate problem with how much toxin you're delivering to that region of the tumor and you get off-target effects. I think this is solvable probably with dosing and spacing. Response rate of 15% or 40% is certainly better than the experience of giving topotecan and dealing with that toxicity and modest benefits. So I think Rova-T will find its place probably post-immunotherapy. I was thinking it's going to be a third-line setting after Nivo-Ipi, but now that Atezo is a first-line drug, it could still have a place in the second-line setting if immunotherapy is kind of spent or given or used, I should say, in the first-line setting, and then you give something else second-line. It may complement. There's an ongoing study right now with Nivo-Ipi and Rova-T.
Wow.
So we'll see what that shows. But I wouldn't count Rova-T out. I think it got a lot of early fanfare, some modest benefits with further follow-up, but pivotal first-line studies are in progress. A study called Peru and Maru are in progress, looking at the role of Rova-T in a first-line setting and in a maintenance setting.
And I see here that your patient had this problem with the fatigue and edema, but also, actually, I guess she was on it for a year, so.
Most of the doctors, certainly, that I work with here in Nashville, but certainly colleagues on the initial study, will tell you this story of, yeah, my patient actually was doing reasonably well. Maybe not great responses, but just no growth, disease control. Not used to seeing that, you know, with chemotherapy. And then the accumulation of edema. And that ultimately it wasn't disease that was the reason that this patient ended up stopping therapy or coming off or succumbing. It ended up being toxicity that forced a stopping of therapy and even a move to hospice in the case of some patients. So, you know, I think you're gonna see this in breast cancer ADC trials. You're gonna see this in other ADC studies. You know, this toxicity that is related to the toxin. And I think this will probably come down to drug design in terms of how much you're delivering and what you're delivering. The ADC field is very exciting. And, you know, right now, the things you can attach to a linker may not need to be a toxin. It might be something that recruits immune cells or affects the microenvironment. So we might get away from some of that traditional thinking and use these drugs, this technology, to attack tumors in a very different way. These kinds of studies are actually in progress right now.
That is really interesting. And I have to say, though, I don't know, like, I think about, you know, as you mentioned, T-DM1, you have brentuximab vedotin. There's this mirvetuximab in ovarian cancer that causes these problems with vision and all. But I don't remember hearing any of them causing edema. And I'm trying to even think of drugs that cause massive edema like that. You know, what do you think?
Well, you know, it's funny when I talk with my colleague, Skip Burris, he always reminds me that, you know, David, we saw these kind of things early on when we gave high doses of paclitaxel and docetaxel before we knew the dosing.
Oh, interesting.
We actually saw these things.
Really?
You don't know this because the doses you use are much lower.
Wow.
In the way we give it. But if you give enough microtubule inhibitor to a patient, you'll see some of these toxicities.
And actually, I'm pretty sure it was Skip and you guys who gave, I think, the first dose of T-DM1.
Yeah, Skip dosed, I guess, the first patient in the world, a woman from Chattanooga, who I think is still doing really well with T-DM1s. You know, these drugs clearly belong in the toolbox in various cancers. I think ADCs have had a difficult time making it into kind of a broad use in oncology, but there is a wave of drugs coming. And like I said, it's not just the toxins that they're attached to. I think there's a little bit more innovative designs and attaching them to things that might recruit T-cells or affect the microenvironment in terms of making a, you know, a cold tumor hot.
So let's try to breeze through a bunch of things related to non-small cell. I don't even know where to start. Things are changing so much. I asked you for a bunch of cases, but maybe we ought to just really focus on some of the new data sets and bring in cases as they come in. So real simple question. First-line therapy of metastatic squamous cell. How are you approaching it nowadays, and what happened at ASCO?
Well, it's funny. I just did a phone call with some colleagues around the country that you're friends with as well, and we talked about this. I think the new standard of care is carboplatin, a taxane, your choice of paclitaxel or nab-paclitaxel, and pembrolizumab. And I say that because of results from a phase 3 study we saw at ASCO, actually not a plenary session, but an oral session nonetheless, KEYNOTE-407. And so, to me, this trial, which met its endpoints for PFS and OS, and did not seem to be contingent on PD-L1 expression, reminded me a little bit of the CheckMate 017 experience with nivolumab, where PD-L1 didn't seem to correlate with benefit in the squamous population. I don't know if there's something unique about squamous patients, but in this study, 407, everybody benefits. So in my view, if you have squamous lung cancer, advanced squamous lung cancer, this is the new standard. Now, we heard about other studies Empower 132, where patients got platinum taxane plus atezolizumab, there was benefit as well for progression-free survival. Not so clear what the benefit is for overall survival yet. I think there'll be other checkpoint inhibitors in this space, maybe Nivo/Ipi. But for me, right now, the data looks strongest with pembrolizumab. Now, not yet FDA approved. Can you give it? Yeah, I think you can. It's not in our formularies. It's not actually in pathways yet. But I can tell you they're all ready to go as soon as the FDA approves that. I can't see the FDA not approving that unless there's something hidden in the data we're not aware of. So it looks very much like 189 for non-squamous patients, carboplatin, pemetrexed, and pembrolizumab. So I think that's the new standard for squamous cancer.
So as in non-squamous, the issue comes up of what about the patient with a high PD-L1 level? Maybe they don't have that aggressive a tumor, maybe they're older, and the possibility of pembrolizumab alone.
Yeah, well, this is obviously the big question right now, because the plenary session at ASCO, a pivotal publication, which is called KEYNOTE-042, looked at pembrolizumab versus chemotherapy, platinum doublet chemotherapy, in both squamous and non-squamous lung cancer, and you had to have only 1% PD-L1 expression, not 50% or higher. So if you remember KEYNOTE-024, which was the pivotal pembro alone versus chemo, same design, but in this case, 50% or higher expression, remarkable benefit, a new standard of care. Now the bar has been lowered for 1% or higher. So the study met its endpoint. It met its endpoint for overall survival. And I think because of that, it will get approved. But what was troubling about the data is that when you look at the subsets, those patients who have lower expression of PD-L1, so the 1 to 49% group, there's crossover in the early period where patients who actually got chemotherapy seem to do better for progression-free survival. We haven't seen the overall survival in that group, but progression-free survival than the group that got pembrolizumab alone. So here we are. The FDA, I suspect, will approve pembrolizumab in 1% or higher. And what are we going to do? If a patient walked in today with squamous or non-squamous lung cancer, for me, and they had less than 50% expression of PD-L1, for me, it's chemotherapy and pembrolizumab. If a patient has 50% or higher, I think that's a conversation of pembrolizumab or chemo plus pembrolizumab. And I have to tell you, Neil, I've done a 180 here where I was a firm believer. Actually, Heather Wakely and I had a little bit of a debate about this, where she argued for combination therapy, and I was arguing for monotherapy, but I've changed course, and I think Heather's correct. I think the data look compelling for those high expressors for the combination. So it looks good for mono, but I think if you have high expression, you may even do better if you get chemo plus pembro. And I think that's the way to go. You mentioned, well, maybe your PS2 or your elderly patient should just get mono. I guess people will think that way. But, you know, we already have studies, multiple studies that have shown us that patients with poor performance status, patients who are elderly, deserve access to platinum-based doublet therapy. Although just this past week, we saw some updated data from the MILES studies, which suggests maybe single-agent chemotherapy is sufficient. I think for every patient, it's kind of a case-by-case decision. But I tend to lean towards 189 and 407 for all my patients at the moment, regardless of PD-L1 expression. And one can make a good argument, why do PD-L1 expression testing anymore if you're not going to use it to make a decision what you give?
Let me challenge you a little bit and say you have somebody who has a PD-L1 level of 90% and they don't have any life-threatening, you know, disease at that point. Why not just start the pembro alone? Maybe if they don't do well, add in chemo.
So I think doctors tend to practice based on their experience, and that's maybe good and not so good sometimes. But I've had those cases, Neil. I've had those cases when we were all at ESMO and we got the 024 data and I raced home and I started giving mono pembro. In fact, we weren't even using pembro at Sarah Cannon initially because we were doing a lot of other studies, but started using a lot of mono pembro. I had those patients with 100% expression who fell off a cliff. And I rescued some of them with platinum doublet chemotherapy. It's anecdotal. But, you know, when you start to see some of these other data sets and you start thinking about, boy, two cycles of pemetrexed and carboplatin just are not that bad. Even if you made it paclitaxel and nab-paclitaxel, things we were doing for years is really not that difficult. And if I can avoid dropping off a cliff with a patient, maybe that's the way to go. I actually would love to see a study of just that, where you get the three drugs for just two cycles and then bail on the chemotherapy, no maintenance chemo, and then just give your checkpoint inhibitor. And then I'd like to see less checkpoint inhibitor. Maybe you give it every 6 weeks or every 12 weeks, Do you really need it that often, every 3 weeks or every 4 weeks? So I think we're moving in that direction. I know ECOG, or I know the Alliance, is poised to do some of these kind of studies to look at sequencing. But, you know, for now, I think there's a role for monotherapy. And if a patient walked in and said, Dr. Spiegel, I just don't want chemo. I just don't want to get it. I just had a patient last week tell me this. He's on a study with actually Nivo-Ipi. And he said, David, it's been 2 years. I'm coming off this because of the study. And if I recur, do you have to put me on chemo? I'd like to go back on immunotherapy. I think there's just this innate fear or concern about having to go on chemo. And I get that, you know. And so I'm not saying chemo's for everybody, but chemo often isn't that bad for a lot of people and can be helpful and keep them from kind of falling off a cliff.
So you referred to first-line therapy of non-squamous, and obviously with the carbo-pemetrexed pembrolizumab approach. Can you talk, though, about other data sets that have been presented in that space and how you see other options?
Well, so we have several. I mentioned the pivotal KEYNOTE-024 study, and then I mentioned the KEYNOTE-042 study, which just was presented in the 1% or higher. We have other data now, though. We have a study with atezolizumab, what's called the EMPOWER 150 study. This is an interesting trial looking at platinum doublet chemotherapy with bevacizumab, so carboplatin, paclitaxel, bevacizumab, and giving kind of atezo with that. So a four-drug regimen, carboplatin, paclitaxel, bevacizumab, and atezolizumab, and then a regimen, a third arm of chemotherapy with atezolizumab. And what we know from that EMPOWER 150, and it's been published in the New England Journal now, Mark Sosinski is the first author. And actually, Neil, I heard this past week, it's NCCN compendia listed. I haven't looked it up online, but I heard it made the compendia. That's a positive study. So that study met its endpoints for PFS and OS, a trial of a four-drug regimen in non-squamous lung cancer. We still don't know how good atezo versus bev is, but we know the four-drug regimen is better than just chemo. So that's a new standard. Should we use it? I guess if you're a big fan of paclitaxel and bevacizumab-based regimens, I think that's a reasonable regimen. For me, if I was going to choose that regimen versus 189, 189 is a regimen I'm a little bit more comfortable with, and I don't think I've seen enough to say that 150 is better than 189 or vice versa. They look pretty similar to me. What there's been a lot of buzz about is in the 150 study, they allowed patients to go on who had EGFR and ALK alterations who had already received standard of care TKI therapy. These patients were often excluded from some of the other pivotal trials, and then they could go on to the study. So you got something like erlotinib for an EGFR mutated lung cancer, and then you went on 150. And when you look at the forest plots in those subsets, they seem to benefit also. And so these are the first data from a prospective randomized phase 3 study where you see benefit for checkpoint inhibitor strategies in patients with EGFR alterations specifically. And so I've heard some buzz since ASCO that goes like this. If I have a patient on osimertinib and they progress, I think I would go to 150 next. I don't think there's anything wrong with that strategy. I don't think there were patients that got OC that went on 150, or there weren't many of them. I don't think that's wrong for that strategy, but we don't know that that still wouldn't be a good strategy with 189 either. I mean, I think...
And when you talk about these numbers, can you specify the regimens again?
So it's the old 4599 regimen, the Alan Sandler regimen of carboplatin, paclitaxel, and bevacizumab. You know, a regimen that's a great regimen. We've used it forever. And then add atezo to it. That's what that is.
But what you're saying, and I've heard this also from investigators, first of all, up until now, people have been saying if a patient relapses on OC or they get, you know, erlotinib and T790, whatever, they get chemo without a checkpoint inhibitor, get a checkpoint inhibitor later. And just as you said, what I'm starting to hear people talk about is the combination of chemo plus checkpoint inhibitor in these EGFR or targetable patients.
I mean, that's where I'm at now. I mean, because we know that in your example, if you're on OC or, you know, take alectinib for that matter, you know, once you exhaust the best TKI therapies we have, what are you going to do? Well, you're going to give them platinum doublet chemotherapy. And I think the natural question is, boy, if the new standard in first-line non-small cell lung cancer is platinum doublet chemo plus a checkpoint, shouldn't I be offering that to my patient with an EGFR alteration who I'm moving into the chemo realm now? The quick answer is we don't know. The only data we have is from EMPOWER 150 with the Atezo and Bev. But there are other studies in progress. In fact, we're doing a study with Suresh Gajeel from the University of Michigan and my colleague Melissa Johnson at Sarah Cannon here. We're now looking at 189 following standard EGFR, TKI, or ALK TKI-directed therapy. You get 189, basically.
And what's 189?
189 is the KEYNOTE-189 study of carboplatin, pemetrexed, and pembrolizumab, or CP squared is what we often refer to as.
CP squared. I like that. CP squared.
I didn't come up with it. I've heard others say that. It's kind of corny.
I like it. I've not heard that. CP squared. Yeah, I like that. Okay, so just to clarify, though, you know, you have all these reimbursement, regulatory issues squirming around, but I think I hear you saying that you would be maybe favoring CP squared, carbo, pem, and pembrolizumab for a patient with, say, EGFR or ALK progressing on targeted therapy, even though really the data is with the carbo, paclitaxel, bev, atezolizumab.
Yeah, that's kind of where I'm at, recognizing fully that we don't have data for that. You know, it does come down to that comfort level of big user of bevacizumab and $45.99 at one time, and then pemetrexed and bevacizumab. I just, for me, because that's the regimen I tend to use the most often right now, and maybe next year I won't, carboplatin, pemetrexed, and pembrolizumab for me is my non-squamous regimen. That's what I often use, what I'm most comfortable with. And I think for a patient off study who's progressing on a TKI and I'm moving into chemotherapy, that's the regimen I would choose for them. But if my colleague here or across the world thought that carboplatin, paclitaxel, bevacizumab, and atezolizumab is the regimen that they want to use, I think that's great. We have data that says that's a good strategy to choose. So I don't see a problem. And that really has nothing to do with cost and comfort level. The regimen looks safe. It's just I choose this other regimen at this point.
I can remember, I think it was a couple of years ago, I'd like joke around at meetings and say that lung cancer is the new breast cancer.
Hey now.
But anybody who's listened to the last hour of our discussion would know that breast cancer was never like this, never. This is wild.
Well, what's funny with breast cancer is, you know, they just hit their first phase 3 study in triple negative breast cancer with paclitaxel and atezo. But even the breast cancer doctors, and I won't point them out, I know a few, they're not so excited about it. And, you know, I'm like, come on, guys, you know, you're like 3 years behind, but it's hit. You should be excited about it and talk about other ways to develop.
I wasn't even talking about checkpoint inhibitors. I was just talking about the amount of change and the rapidity of change and the new data. And like, you know, it's really totally amazing. Yes.
Let me just say one thing about that, because it's going to continue to happen over the next couple of years with a lot of new data. So I'm a little concerned about a couple of things. One is that these early looks, interim analyses, and presentations, we heard about another positive study for carboplatin, pemetrexed, and atezo in non-squamous lung cancer. And what we heard is the PFS is positive, but the interim OS is not positive. But you know, Neil, in time, these things can change. Look at 21G, Corey Langer study, you know, a study that had no hint of OS advantage and then later did and then was proven in 189. I think we can get swayed sometimes by early looks and presentations that, and there's a lot of reasons for that enthusiasm. But the other thing that bothers me is when you look at a study like 042, a study at first glance, at a press release glance, looks great. Looks like it hit all its endpoints, hence a plenary session. But when you dig into the data, even at a presentation level, not at a manuscript level, you know, you start to see some concerns about the way things look. And it's important to look at these studies in more detail and understand what the pros and cons are. I'm the first to tell you that I get excited about something like KEYNOTE 407, where we jump into squamous lung cancer. And I told you it's a new standard of care. And yet I haven't seen the full data set. You know, you got to temper some of that. I'm guilty of being too excited and ready to use that in my patients. And at the same time, I recognize there could be something hidden there that we don't know. So we got to give time for these trials to mature and learn about where they belong in the kind of sequence of therapy. But you're right, it's a lot of stuff. Everything's coming out quickly. It's hard to keep up with, even if you focus on lung cancer.
So let's finish out and talk a little bit about checkpoint inhibitors and locally advanced disease. And maybe to get into that, we can hear about your 57-year-old patient.
Yeah, well, this was a gentleman. Actually, what's fun right now is this gentleman just moved, because he's doing so well. He just moved from Nashville to Indiana, and one of our good friends, Nasser Hanna at IU, has inherited him and doing a good job managing him. But the long and short of it is a gentleman with stage 3 unresectable lung cancer, squamous, as I recall, who actually went on Pacific. And so a randomized study, you remember, where you got chemo RT and then randomized to 1 year of every 2 week durvalumab or placebo, kind of a difficult study to get randomized to if you think about it. Not only do you have to do a year of something, but that could be placebo. But this gentleman went on it and ultimately the study was positive, but he also benefited from that. And we know he was on that treatment arm. I knew early on, actually, because of his range of toxicities. So not just pneumonitis, but he had some rash issues. And, you know, he's benefited from that. One patient that we've seen in a large intent to treat analysis where patients benefit not only in terms of progression-free survival, but now overall survival. So a new standard of care, it's been FDA approved. Chemo RT, the regimen is not specified. It's kind of dealer's choice. But what I'll mention is no need for induction therapy, no need for consolidative therapy, and then you get durvalumab for a year.
When you say no need for it, so this patient got carboplatin, wouldn't you normally give consolidation chemo for a couple cycles?
That's the biggest, I call it the Corey Langer argument. You know, that's the biggest kind of arrow, I think, to shoot at the Pacific is, now, wait a minute, there's all these different chemo RT regimens. You know, there's cisplatin, etoposide, there's carboplatin. Some doctors like to give two additional cycles, as you say, a full dose carboplatin following 6 weeks of chemo RT. Some actually still do induction therapy where they give a couple of cycles before all that. And we still haven't seen all the breakdown of all those regimens. But what I can tell you is in this study, it didn't matter what regimen you got as long as you got chemo RT and then you were split into the durvalumab or not. So in theory, a mixture of different regimens in a large phase 3 study, balanced regimens, balanced by randomization, the only difference, the only factor that seems to be the difference maker in terms of the outcomes is the receipt of durvalumab. Now, there certainly could be confounding issues, as you mentioned, but I've changed my practice. I no longer give consolidative therapy. I give chemo RT. I do give carboplatin paclitaxel, and it does feel a little bit short. But I think this is what the study showed us, and that's the way I treat patients and give them durvalumab following that. It just got asked of me yesterday, and you know, an issue that's come up is these patients that go to surgery for presumed stage 1 and 2 disease are discovered to have stage 3 disease and 2 nodes at surgery. And then we give them adjuvant chemotherapy and post-op radiation therapy. And now the question is, should we give them Pacific? And, you know, those patients were not in the study. We don't know. But what makes you kind of irritated about is that very patient, had you known they had N2 disease, you wouldn't have taken them to surgery. You would have given them Pacific. So I think a lot of doctors are wrestling right now, me included, where I get that patient, we finish chemo, we do post-op radiotherapy, and the question comes up, should we get immunotherapy now? The textbook answer is no. That regimen is not indicated for you. You are not part of that study. But I can tell you a lot of us are wondering if that's the approach we should be using for that patient.
How long is it before we're going to see adjuvant data for checkpoint inhibitors? And what do you think it's going to show?
Well, I think it's going to come very soon. We just finished enrollment to a large phase 3 study of atezolizumab in early stage disease. The neoadjuvant trials have looked fantastic. You know, I think Patrick Ford's work in the New England Journal this past April out of Hopkins, looking at the value of nivolumab preoperatively. You know, these drugs are very active. And I think checkpoint inhibitors are going to move into earlier stage disease, earlier than stage 3 disease. So yeah, my guess would be that the atezo, the first adjuvant study I'm aware of that closed, would hit. But you know, that's a big guess. I thought bevacizumab and ECOG 1505 would hit, and it didn't hit. So we'll have to wait and see. Clearly no role for immunotherapy in the adjuvant setting other than in stage 3 with durvalumab. And by that, let me just also mention, I don't think there's a role for any other drug than durvalumab in the stage 3 setting. Even though we just saw some good single cohort study data with pembrolizumab at ASCO, I don't personally think that's ready for prime time. I think you can look at those data and say it match up with Pacific, but Pacific is a randomized phase 3 study. I just think durvalumab is the drug for right now.
Could you talk a little bit more about what exactly was seen in PACIFIC, both in terms of efficacy, also in terms of toxicity? This man actually got the entire year durvalumab and now has been off therapy for 2 years, doing great, it sounds like. What was actually seen in the study?
Well, we know the endpoints hit. We know response rate, PFS, OS hit. The concern I think you hit on pretty quickly is toxicity. And really, we're getting into pneumonitis. What's interesting for me is, you know, all of us have treated stage three cancer for a long time, and we've all, you know, for a long time have done concurrent chemo RT. It just seems like now we're making a lot more of pneumonitis because it seems to be something we're paying a lot more attention to. It used to be we treat somebody and then we follow them and we kind of let them taper off, you know, the therapy they were on and deal with those lingering side effects. But now you're trying to get them on a durva. And so I don't know if it's because I'm assessing them more frequently or doing more scans because I'm nervous about pneumonitis. So pneumonitis was seen on the study a little bit higher rate of pneumonitis than in the control group. But you have time. You can get pneumonitis from chemo RT, let that resolve, and then give patients durvalumab, even as late as 3 months later. I don't think there's anything magic about the timeline. I'm a little nervous about finishing chemo RT on a Monday and starting durvalumab on a Friday. I don't think that makes sense, although the study allowed you to do that. I think you have to get people through this pneumonitis. Just yesterday, I was in clinic. I have a gentleman that's very eager to get started with durvalumab, but we've had 3.5 weeks of pneumonitis issues, of antibiotics, steroids. He even ended up in the hospital a couple of weeks ago. And he asked me just yesterday, David, can we start durvalumab? And I said, no way. You're a month at least before I'm going to do that. He says, well, I'm off steroids in 3 days. Well, you've got to show me you can be off steroids and do well. In fact, I want to do scans again to see where we are. Because you can have somebody re-expose them to durva and see pneumonitis again, and then it's one step forward and 10 back. You know, you have to take a long time off. Even the gentleman I mentioned that's now being cared for by Dr. Hanna in Indiana, we had a period of pneumonitis where we had to come off and take a break, and I didn't think we'd come back on. But, you know, obviously he did well. I just think it's a serious toxicity. You can have all the other things that happen, but I think PACIFIC, you know, the big worry is pneumonitis. And it's going to be the worry for all of our trials in small cell, extensive and limited stage setting, anything where radiation is going to be used, that's going to be a concern for us with patients with lung cancer.
I think actually when a lot of people saw the PACIFIC data, they were kind of relieved.
You know, yeah.
It sort of sounds like a bad idea to blast somebody with chemo radiation and then give them a checkpoint inhibitor. But I mean, yeah, it's there, but you know, you could imagine it could have been a lot worse. It doesn't seem to be that common.
Remember this, Neil, you know, Julie Bramer, she and her colleagues at Hopkins, I mean, remember the early experience, you know, you had a death or a couple of deaths at Hopkins with pneumonitis, with nivolumab. And I have pneumonitis in patients on other agents for stage four disease. And it can be a struggle, you know, that can go on for a year or two where you're on and off and frequent antibiotics, sometimes hospitalization. Pneumonitis is a big deal for lung cancer patients. You know, it's a big deal if you had breast cancer or you had colorectal cancer, but it's especially a big deal for lung cancer where you're already often dealing with emphysema, obstructive airway disease, surgery, maybe radiation for some issues, like we mentioned, and then you get pneumonitis. I mean, it can be a bear for a patient.
Yeah, really, it's interesting how different the stories are that we hear in lung cancer compared to melanoma and all other kinds of places in terms of, you know, for obvious.
You know, it's funny, this came up in a conversation recently where you hear people say things like, well, melanoma, patients with melanoma can tolerate toxicity different than patients with lung cancer, and therefore the dosing should be different for these regimens. I mean, I guess there's some truth to that for the reasons I just outlined. It is hard to imagine, though, if you had a patient with each cancer, but the same histories, like no surgery, no COPD, you know, there's nothing inherent about the biology of cancer, I would think, that would mean that your toxicity in an organ system should be different. It's probably what baggage you have coming into it.
Absolutely. Also, there's a diagnostic issue that happens in lung cancer. What actually happened with this man? What kind of condition was he in when you started the durvalumab, and then what happened?
We had a scare in the beginning where he got really sick early on and actually found out from the company at that time that there was a little bit of an alarm with some other cases around the world. And remember, the study was randomized, so it was unblinded to folks about, you know, who was getting the toxicity. Just it was known that there was some pneumonitis occurring. And you know, in these phase 3 studies, really any study, but a phase three study, if you have a lot of early events, toxicity or deaths or coming off study, it can kill a trial. You know, and I was seeing this with my own patient, you know, is he an example of what's happening around the world? But he weathered that, got on to Durva, had a little bit of a flare on and off, you know, early in his course. And then we settled into a rhythm and, you know, finished a year of treatment. And then it's been close to going on 2 years off Durva and doing well. I mean, you know, is he cured? I would say statistically, you know, the odds are not in his favor of being cured, but he's doing quite well and will continue to be watched closely and knows that if he recurs, you know, we're going to have other things for him. I get asked that too, like, what do you do if you recur after Durva? I think you look at that like any recurrence after adjuvant treatment, whether it's for small cell or for, like, for limited stage disease or whether it's for stage two cancer. If you get your primary therapy for early stage disease and you recur a long time later, you probably are a candidate for that same therapy again. And if you're somebody who got Durva and 2 months later you recur, I'm not too eager to give that patient immunotherapy again. I'm not sure that they're going to benefit. So that's the way I look at it. If this gentleman recurs, I think he's a candidate for immunotherapy again. Had he recurred right after we finished Durva, I would say no. I think he'd say you need to move on and look at other strategies.
So, but just to be clear, he developed pneumonitis while on durvalumab.
Yeah, he had pneumonitis before he was randomized.
So he had pneumonitis that was related to the radiation therapy.
Yeah, although my radiation oncology colleagues would say to his chemo radiation therapy.
So he had pneumonitis, but...
Yeah, that's correct. We got that under control. He remained eligible for treatment, went on study, and then he had a flare in his pneumonitis. And we, I mean, probably for 2 months, we had these frequent visits up and down, steroids, hold, antibiotics often. And then we reached a period where none of that happened again. And it was a point for the first couple of months where, like, every visit I was expecting him to come off study or some other issue. And then we reached a period where things were just fine. So,
but just to be clear, the study allowed people to go on durvalumab who already had radiation or chemo radiation pneumonitis.
If it resolved. If you got that resolved and they were off steroids.
And it sounds like you're comfortable doing that right now off study. So you have a patient who's having radiation pneumonitis, it resolves, you're okay with using durvalumab.
Absolutely. I think it's a high risk. Even my patient that didn't have pneumonitis that went on to durvalumab, always watching out for it. I think the patient had it resolved. Yeah, definitely a little more cautious with that patient in terms of visits and being attuned to starting steroids, but not a reason to prohibit use of Durva if you've gotten control of pneumonitis, in my view.
In your mind, are you using this with the hope of improving the chance of cure?
Yes, no question. I mean, you look at 20% with our 20-year approach of chemo RT, I mean, we've got to do better. I think a lot of critics would say, David, all you're doing is you're taking patients with distant disease, you know, occult disease, and you're giving them something like KEYNOTE-024 early. You're giving them immunotherapy early. This was like the switch conversation, switch maintenance studies, you know, the famous FIDES trial with docetaxel.
Right.
You're just giving therapy earlier than they would have gotten had you just waited for them to recur later. There's probably truth to that. I mean, in theory, you're addressing micrometastatic or occult disease. I think when you can start to affect survival, I think that's a difference maker for patients.
Just out of curiosity, you know, when you look at the numbers, you think about indirect comparison, you know, sort of understand the biology of the disease. Do you think there's a synergy going on between the chemo radiation and the checkpoint inhibitors, or just sort of one plus one?
I don't know. I have to admit, I'm a little bit of a skeptic on, not that abscopal effects don't occur, I've just been a little bit skeptical on what that really means in the clinic. You know, there's still ongoing work looking at that, giving somebody a little bit of radiation to a part of their body and seeing what it does systemically. I guess it's in the back of my mind, and I do say that to a patient, like it may be that this would be another thing to stir the pot of your immune system. So when we give you a checkpoint inhibitor, you release the brakes and it works more. I just have not been so convinced of that from data I've seen. I mean, Pacific is Pacific. It included RT. But I could make the case that, look at CheckMate 026, Mark's Nevo first-line study versus chemo. I think it was 40% of patients had received radiotherapy at some point in their care, randomized, so equal groups, and one group gets Nevo. That study was not positive. Now, is that a Nevo issue? I don't see that radiation per se is something that's going to be a difference maker in terms of how you respond to immunotherapy. I love if that were true and you could send a patient over to get one fraction of radiation to some part of their body and then see that that helps them, but I've not been convinced of that yet.
So a couple other questions related to this. What do we know about PD-1 levels and benefit from durvalumab as consolidation? Is it something that a clinician should look at all? And what about the patient with a targetable mutation such as EGFR and ALK with locally advanced disease?
I tell you, the Durva data to me have been disappointing when it comes to expression. First of all, the cutoff for the Durva studies by and large has been 25%. And if you look at the various subsets across studies that have been published, it's a little bit all over the map. Even the Durva-Tremi data are a little bit all over the map in that you don't see the stair-step approach where the higher expression, it's convincing that you benefit. In fact, you see a little bit of everything where no expression, 25% expression, 100% expression seems to be associated with the same efficacy outcomes. So for me, Durva and PD-L1 expression don't go together. I don't think that's a tool to help me decide how to use Durva. The EGFR story, I think, is a bit mixed. The reason I say it like that is I think if Durva were in IMpower 150 instead of Atezo, probably the results would be the same. We don't have data like that. What we do have, though, are some concerning issues. Jeff Oxner is leading an early study of Durva with various TKIs. And in that study, I think it's called the TATIN trial, there were some early concerns about mixing that checkpoint inhibitor with some of the TKI-directed therapies. And these are modern TKIs, next generation. And so your question was about should an EGFR patient get Durva? I think that's probably going to be fine. But there are some concerns about should you get these immunotherapeutics with your TKI. And the only data we've seen that look a little more concerning have been with Durva.
In general, are you putting patients with targetable mutations on Durva consolidation after chemoradiation?
Well, so if I had a patient with stage 3 cancer with an EGFR mutation, I'm not giving them a TKI. I give them chemo RT followed by Durva. So yes, that's what I do. I was recently in a meeting, though, with two colleagues who said they won't do that. They said that that patient, they don't think should get Durva. You know, we can get down into this debate, but I don't feel that way. I think Pacific is Pacific, and it took everybody, you know, it took patients, gave them standard of care therapy for stage 3 disease, and gave them immunotherapy. I don't think because you have an EGFR mutation, you should veer from concurrent chemo RT, and in this case, adjuvant immunotherapy, unless you're just a big believer that none of that stuff makes sense and they should only get a TKI like you get for stage 4 disease. I don't think that's ready for prime time.
I got to say, you know, we've asked, we've polled, we do surveys all the time of investigators, and up to what you just said with these two people, we were getting pretty straightforward responses. The trial included them. I'm treating them, you know, so.
Yeah, they got a little bit of pushback. It was a friendly kind of round table, and I think there were like 12 of us, and so I think the other 10 kind of ganged up a little bit on them. But, you know, look, I see where they're coming from. They feel a little uncomfortable about the oncogenic-driven tumor settings being not so clear and what to do. I think one of those two said, I would eventually give immunotherapy to a patient with an EGFR mutation way down the road. So I think most people don't think, you know, it has no role. I just think they're more selective about when to use it. Can I tell you one more thing that just happened? And Neil, I've shared it with you before, but because I just saw her, it's worth mentioning again.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, of course.
So this is a young woman who's in her early 50s who presented with advanced lung cancer, non-squamous, kind of pan-negative for an alteration. And we put her on a trial with Nivo-Ipi. And she got one dose. She came in week 2 at the 2-week point for her second dose of Nivo, but her LFTs were up. So we had to hold treatment. She was asymptomatic. Week 4, her LFTs were up, and so I gave her steroids. Week 6, they came down, got her off steroids, and by week 8, she was off steroids, LFTs corrected, ready to get treated again. She looked so good, I said, why don't we just take a look and see what's going on? And we did scans, and she had a near complete response. She already did not like coming in to see me and said, boy, why do I have to do anything? And I said, you know, I've never done this with stage 4 lung cancer, but if you want to take a little more time, we can. So we actually delayed as long as we could on the study, but at some point we had to come off. I think it was after the second set of scans. We kept doing this, Neil. checking her, watching her closely. She just came in 2 weeks ago for her 2-year scan. And she has what I would say is basically a complete response. And the reason I won't say 100% is because you can go in and see a little bit of smudge in her right upper lung. She got one dose of Nevo, one dose of Ipi, and that was it. So I went and looked at her tumor mutation burden, and it came back at 115.
Wow.
And I don't know if she's cured. I mean, I would say she's not. She probably has occult disease. Wouldn't that be pretty cool? A patient comes into your clinic, you get a score, you just need one dose, and we're going to watch you. I mean, I've never seen anything like that.
Be cooler if you could sort of make that happen, you know, but actually...
I was telling Dr. Greco, Tony Greco, you know, one of my colleagues the other day, we were talking a lot about this. What if you could alter TMB? What if you could make somebody more sensitive to immunotherapy, yeah, maybe radiation or what, to get to that so-called score and then know that you don't need to give more of this stuff?
What was her PD-1 level?
Again, at that time, that was all central, and I don't know that I ever saw that.
That is really wild. What an amazing case and really a commentary. I was, at some point along the way in this conversation, you referred to one of the trials of maintenance, and I was thinking of maintenance chemo. And I was thinking about the kinds of trials. I was actually interviewing Martin Reck the other day when we first doing CME in lung cancer 15, 16 years ago. There was a study of 4 different platinum doublets up front, you know, and they were all the same. And it was just like nothing, you know, maintenance, chemo, you know, Bev, whatever. It was like getting old. And now all of a sudden it's just like, whoa.
I will tell you, there's a little bit of, it's not apathy, but it's a little bit of not quite the same oomph we were getting when the first immuno studies hit. I think, you know, Marty will tell you this, a little bit of like, oh, okay, you know, another press release. I mean, it's kind of, maybe that's a good thing that we're getting a little more comfortable with all the good news coming out of lung cancer. But I think all of us sitting in a room would say, we still don't know what to do after these therapies. You know, all these patients are going to recur, and we still don't know what to do for them. And I know drugs like osimertinib and alectinib and brigatinib, great, great therapies, but we still don't know what to do with folks after they finish those.
Absolutely. It's just that there's so much to talk about now.